people throughout history have always believed that the time that they were alive is the most special time, that they live at the end of history. And this was true for the Greeks, for the Romans, for the Mayas, for the Aztecs. They were obviously wrong. So this is the point that historians often like to make. Don't think you are so special. But I think there's actually a good case to be made that we are living through incredible world historic times, that indeed this time is different. What is the most important thing that happened in all of human history? I would say there are a couple of candidates. Maybe it was the birth of the great prophets, like Jesus or Muhammad. Maybe it was the rise and the fall of the great empires, like the Aztecs or the Vikings. Maybe it was the invention of the wheel, the compass, the printing press. There's also another way to look at this question, to basically look at the numbers. Whether you look at the growth of world population, the growth of global GDP, the growth of CO2 emissions, it's the same graph over and over and over again. What you see is a line that is basically flat for thousands of years. Nothing much seems to be happening. Then an explosion around the year 1750, which was the Industrial Revolution, and then a rocket is launched. And the big question is, how is this story gonna end, right? If you look at those graphs, then you start getting the feeling that we may be nearing the end of the movie, right? This is the moment when the music is swelling and we get to find out whether this rocket is gonna burst into the Milky Way, right? And we're gonna colonize the galaxy and beyond, or whether this whole thing is gonna crash and burn.
If this is true, that we are living in historic times, then how we spend our lives today matter a lot.
For this video, I got to sit down with the famous Dutch historian and author Rutger Bregman to talk about what we can do today to live lives that actually matter.
It's a pretty important fundamental insight that life is short. Life on average lasts for around 4,000 weeks and a career for around 2,000 work weeks. And that time, how you spend that time is, you know, potentially your greatest contribution to making this world a much better place. But the sad reality is that currently a lot of brilliant people are stuck in not very meaningful jobs. We can look at two variables here. How ambitious you are and how idealistic you are. First, we have the people who are not very ambitious and not very idealistic. Many of them are stuck in what the great anthropologist David Graeber called bullshit jobs. That's the technical scientific term here. So those are jobs that are just socially meaningless. And it's not me saying it, it's people themselves saying it about their own work.
In one interesting study, researchers found that 11% of private sector workers see their own jobs as socially meaningless, compared with only 3% of public sector workers. And among firefighters, librarians, and nurses, 0% believed that their work was meaningless, while in jobs like sales, marketing, and PR, 21% said that their work was meaningless. That's the type of jobs that belong in Rutger's category of non-ambitious and non-idealistic work.
Now, you also have people who are quite idealistic, actually, but not very ambitious. I think you can see that a lot in my own bubble. I'm a guy who cares deeply about something like climate change. But then you see a lot of people who are obsessed with, for example, their own environmental footprint. They say, you don't fly, you can't eat meat, you can't have kids, you can't use plastic straws, that's the worst thing. But then the best possible scenario is that you will have reduced your footprint to zero, you might as well not have existed, right? So it's not very ambitious. I think you can also see this among people who are called quote-unquote woke. They care very much about the language we use to describe all the injustices in the world. But the point is obviously not just to raise awareness and use the right words. The point is to actually change the world. And then finally, you also have people who are quite ambitious, but not very idealistic. Currently, around 30 to 40% of Harvard graduates end up in what a good friend of mine calls the Bermuda Triangle of talent. So that's consultancy, corporate law, and finance. It's this gaping black hole that sucks up so many bright young people.
It's no surprise that talented young people want to have high-paying jobs, but it's also a bit problematic because researchers have found that how much work pays often correlates with how immoral that type of work is perceived to be. So if our most talented young people follow the money, then they will often end up in what society believes are the most immoral industries.
There's this quote from a guy who worked at Facebook more than a decade ago now, and he said it well. He said, "The best minds of my generation are thinking about how to make people click ads." Now, what do we actually want? We obviously want the combination of ambition on the one hand and idealism on the other hand. And that's what I describe as moral ambition.
So if we want to live morally fulfilling lives that actually matter, then we should spend our lives in this top right quadrant. But why are so few of us doing that? Well, Rutger argues that this is because we buy into 6 myths about doing good.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit.
This is Gordon Gekko from the 1987 movie Wall Street. In this scene, Gordon expresses a belief that runs deep in our economic system today, that selfishness, even greed, can still be moral. This idea builds on a perverted version of Adam Smith's invisible hand, the idea that if everyone just chases their own self-interest, the market will magically transform this greed into benefits for everyone. And with that logic, obviously, we don't even need to think morally because greed is enough. Profits will make the world a better place. Today, we know what even Adam Smith realized, which is that greed and profits alone won't create a better world. But even if you reject the greed is good story and genuinely want to do good, Rutger argues that there are 6 powerful myths that still hold people back. And Rutger calls these the 6 myths of the noble loser.
So the first myth we got to talk about is the awareness myth. Awareness is vastly overrated. The fact that people watch this YouTube video, well, it's nice, but it's just a very small first step. People are aware that we treat animals horrendously. People are aware that there are massive disparities, you know, how we distribute wealth globally, and still we choose to ignore most of it. The challenge really is to bridge that gap from awareness to action. Yeah, the second myth is the intention myth. Intentions are also quite overrated. But yeah, there are just many examples of well-intentioned people not achieving much or even doing harm. Take a simple example like fair trade. You pay a little bit extra for a product and then that ends up with the poor farmer who really needs that money. Well, look, economists have studied fair trade a lot, and most studies are really negative. If you really care about the poor, then there are much more effective interventions. So the third myth is the myth of the right reasons. People forget that in history, very often, the right things happen for the wrong reasons. So I'll give you an example. The fight against the slave trade in Britain in the 18th century. This was the greatest movement that the world has ever seen, in my view. And it was super effective because it used a technique called moral reframe.
The abolitionists had first tried to convince the politicians in Parliament that slavery should be banned simply because it was morally wrong. But that argument didn't resonate with the politicians.
But then the abolitionists discovered that around 20% of white sailors were dying on these slave ships. And then they had this epiphany, like, this is going to be such a powerful argument in Westminster, because when these politicians hear that our boys are dying on these ships, then they will surely turn against the slave trade. And indeed, that's what happened. Very often in history, the right things happen for the wrong reasons. So the fourth illusion is the illusion of purity. The idea that you can only work together with people who agree with you on all things.
I personally believe that this illusion of purity is fueled by our obsession with left versus right thinking. As I explained in a video last year, the left-right spectrum fools us into thinking that we have to have opinions about all issues that we face today based on where those issues are currently positioned on the left-right spectrum. That type of thinking fuels tribalism and it prevents us from actually solving problems.
Every great movement throughout history, the abolitionists, the suffragettes who fought for women's right to vote, they were coalitions of people who very often didn't agree with one another on really substantial issues. The fifth illusion is the illusion of synergy. This is a concept that was coined by the economist Albert O. Hirschman. He noticed that very often progressives like to think that all good things come together. We need to solve climate change, but at the same time, we also need to reform our whole democracy. We need to implement a universal basic income, a job guarantee, provide equal rights for everyone. We got to do all of that together. And this is, by the way, the only way it will work, because all these different ideas and proposals, they all build upon one another. There are some cases where indeed different proposals can empower one another, but I think very often it's an illusion as well. Let me give you one example from the abolitionist movement again. British abolitionists had to answer the question what they would fight. Would they really take on slavery, the whole institution as such, or would they only focus on fighting the slave trade, right? The transport of enslaved Africans to the colonies. Today, you may think, like, obviously they had to take down the whole system, right? These entrepreneurs, because that's what they were, they came together and they made the very pragmatic decision to initially only focus on the slave trade. So they founded the British Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade. They said, you know, if you stop the flow of enslaved people to the colonies, then that will force these slaveholders to start treating their enslaved people better. And they believe that once you abolish the slave trade, then that will create the fertile political ground that you can build upon to then finally also start attacking the slavery. And this is exactly what happened. After a 25-year-long campaign in 1807, they did get that law through Parliament. The slave trade was abolished. And then another 25 years later, they managed to abolish slavery across the British Empire. The perseverance of these people just deeply inspires me. And they achieved their goal by being radical in their ideals, but being super pragmatic in their methods. And that's what it really takes. So the final myth that we got to talk about is the myth of inevitability. There's this famous saying from Martin Luther King that the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. And MLK said a lot of very wise things, but this was not one of them. There is absolutely no inevitability. History has no destination whatsoever. And if there is justice in this world, then it has to come from us. That's why I talk about moral ambition. It's about the combination of the idealism of an activist and the ambition of an entrepreneur, and then maybe also the rigor of a scientist and the humility of a monk, right? When all those things come together, then, yeah. Well, some people watching this may think, look, I am just not one of those people. I am not one of those historical heroes. I'm happy to do the basics of being a good citizen, but moral ambition, that's a bit too much. And then I would like to emphasize the great heroes of history. They were people just like us. And it's not because they were good persons that they did good things. No, it's the other way around.
This is something that history has shown many times. For example, during the Second World War, as Nazi Germany occupied more and more of Europe, when most people did nothing, a small minority risked everything to resist.
Now, after the Second World War, there have been some really big studies in which researchers interviewed hundreds of resistance heroes who had the courage to hide persecuted Jews in their cellars, for example, really risk their own lives to help those people.
In these studies, the researchers searched for patterns among the resistors, patterns that can tell us who are likely to act morally. Were they mostly young men, mostly poor? What type of person is likely to be morally brave?
It really turned out to be a cross-section of the population, people who are rich and poor and young and old and introverts and extroverts. But then, after a while, they discovered that there was one factor that predicted very well whether people would join the resistance, yes or no. And it was the mere matter of being asked. So in 96% of all cases, when people were asked to do the right thing, they said yes. So moral ambition is not something you're born with. It's not necessarily something you're getting from your parents. No, it's more like a meme. It's almost like a social virus that can spread. This also explains, by the way, why resistance, it wasn't evenly distributed over the country. No, it was a local phenomenon, right? Very often spread by these super spreaders who asked a lot of people, like, can you help? Can you help? For me, this is such a simple but such an important insight, is that you can just get started and then one thing will lead to another. Aristotle made this remark as well, is you do not become a builder because you were born that way. No, you become a builder by building. You become a good person by doing good.
If you want to be morally ambitious today, what causes does it make sense to focus on?
So at the School for Moral Ambition, which is a nonprofit I co-founded that helps as many talented people as possible to work on the most pressing causes, we work with the so-called SSS framework. So we advise people to work on the most sizable, the most solvable, and the most sorely neglected causes of our time. Take something like climate change, for example. Obviously a very sizable problem, right? Threatening millions, if not billions of people. Then is it solvable? The answer is obviously yes. We've got the technologies, we've got the ideas, we can fix it. Is it also sorely neglected? I would say the good news is that it's less and less neglected, right? There are millions of awesome people working on the problem. But that also means that, you know, one extra person working on it will make less additional impact.
Let's compare the problem of climate change with, for example, the problem of biodiversity loss. Biodiversity loss is a problem that is just as existential as climate change, and it is solvable, but in comparison, it gets almost no attention. Or we can look at factory farming and animal suffering. Tens of billions of animals suffer every year, and factory farms drive pandemics and climate change. It is a solvable problem, and it is a problem that is sorely neglected. Or take smoking. Smoking still kills millions of people annually, and we know exactly how to reduce it, and yet it remains far less prioritized than many way smaller health issues that we focus on. So the SSS framework tells us that if you want to be morally ambitious, these are the kinds of causes you should focus on.
So that's the framework we recommend. Don't follow your passion. I always describe it as follow the Gandalf. Gandalf, the wise wizard, he never asked Frodo, hey, Frodo, what's your passion? He said, no, this needs to happen. These are the most, solvable, sizable, and sorely neglected issues. And at the very top is throwing that ring into the mountain. So go and do it.
Hello everyone, I am Andres Acevedo, and this is The Market Exit. So these videos, they take a lot of time to make, and the only way I can keep making them is with your support. So if you enjoy my essays, you can become a Patreon and support me there at patreon.com/themarketexits. And a huge thank you to everyone who are already supporting me. I could not do this without you. And for patrons, I've actually already shared a full podcast-length version of my conversation with Rutger. It's on the Patreon page, so become a patron if you want to check that out. Also, liking this video and subscribing to my channel and sharing this video, that also helps me out, of course, as well. So Rutger's earlier books, Utopia for Realists and Humankind, they had a huge impact on me and I really loved them. So it was a true privilege to be able to sit down with Rutger to interview him about his new book, Moral Ambition. And the book, of course, covers much more than what we could talk about in this video. So I highly recommend reading it. And with that, I will actually let Rutger have the final word. Thank you for watching. Cheers.
My new book, Moral Ambition, with the subtitle, Stop Wasting Your Talent, Start Making Different, is almost like a guide, a self-help manual about how you can make the biggest possible difference in the fight against the greatest challenges that we face as a species. It's the kind of book, I gotta admit, that you may half wish you didn't pick up, because when you finished it, you gotta do something. You know, there are already thousands of books out there that will make you more comfortable, that will teach you that you are good the way you are, that I think that actually, no. You're probably not good the way you are, and you can do much better. Now, it's also, I hope, a pretty inspiring book about some of the greatest pioneers of the past. I talk a lot about the abolitionists, the suffragettes, some of the great builders who brought us the malaria vaccine, the birth control pill. We can learn so much about those who came before us. For me, this is the ultimate form of immortality. It's about living a life worthy of being remembered, you know, making future historians proud of you.